Our next scheduled news headlines on KANU will be at 8 o'clock this evening. Each Monday night at this time, KANU and the Office of the Dean of Women at the University of Kansas present A Feminist Perspective. This program provides a forum for women to speak out on issues which concern them. And listeners will have an opportunity to participate in the program by calling the KANU open line at 864-4530. Now here's our moderator for A Feminist Perspective, KU Dean of Women, Emily Taylor.
Good evening, and welcome to A Feminist Perspective. Feminist Perspective is sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, located in the Dean of Women's office, 222 Strong Hall. Our telephone number is 864-3552. We hope that through this program you can become familiar with some of the many resources available to you through our office. We are concerned with anything that concerns women and have gathered people and materials to help you with your concerns, ranging from career planning and academic counseling to legal rights and current legislation to medical services for women. We hope that you'll call or come by soon so that we can find out what's on your mind and what kinds of services you need or desire. The goal of this program is to provide a forum for women to speak publicly on issues of concern to them and help inform other women and men of the movement which is remaking the shape and substance of women's and men's lives. Tonight, two of our panelists are not women. Dr. Henry Buck, MD, Lawrence Physician Gynecologist, and Dean Cackley, Assistant Dean of Men and a law student at KU, and Terry Edwards, Assistant Dean of Women. Our topic for discussion tonight is the recent Supreme Court ruling on abortion. We've all been reading a great deal about this subject, I'm sure. And I think we ought to start by finding out, you know, what are the essential parts of the Supreme Court decision? And Dean, we'll ask you to tell us what's the essential parts of it.
Well, looking over the decision, the Supreme Court has relied upon the fundamental rights included in the Constitution, specifically in the Bill of Rights and in the 14th Amendment. They've interpreted the Constitution as it has been interpreted in the past to include a right to privacy. And they have now defined that right to encompass a woman's right to make decisions regarding abortions. They weighed the woman's right to privacy and the state's interest in protecting a woman's health and in protecting potential life of the fetus. Then by extending that and relying on medical fact, Justice Blackmun, who wrote the opinion, broke the period of pregnancy into three trimesters and pursued this dichotomy of state interest and right to privacy in those three time zones. During the first trimester, he concluded, the hazards of the medical procedure were small enough that the state's interest in protecting the woman's health were smaller. That interest was smaller than the woman's right to privacy. And that because the fetus was not viable during that first trimester, the state's interest in protecting potential life of the fetus was small. Therefore, during the first trimester, the decision regarding abortion would be left to the woman and her consulting physician. In the second trimester, or second 3 months, because the medical procedures become more complicated, the state's interest in protecting the woman becomes stronger, but because the fetus has not attained viability at that point during the second 3 months, the state's interest in protecting potential life of the fetus remains small. The result of that is that during the second 3 months, the state may impose regulations regarding medical procedures with the safety of the woman in mind. During the third trimester, however, because of the increased complications of the medical procedures, as well as with Now, with the viability of the fetus in the third trimester, the state's interest becomes very strong and outweighs the woman's right to privacy almost entirely. The state, at that point, during the last 3 months, may prescribe or outlaw abortion altogether, except in cases where a woman's life or health may be jeopardized if she doesn't have the abortion administered.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Buck, you have any comment on the medical decisions that went into this Supreme Court ruling?
Well, there are always variations, of course, from the norm. And it happens that the smallest surviving infant weighed 397 grams, which would be consistent with approximately 22 weeks of gestation. We speak in gestation in terms of 40 weeks, so actually by your 6 months, we're talking about 27 to 28 weeks. So actually, infants in the middle trimester have survived. At about 6 months, the survival rate is about 20%. At 7 months, the survival rate is 80%. So that you can see there's a very great leap in terms of survival between the sixth and the seventh month.
20% to 80%
in one month's time. So, and add to that that these figures are probably 4 or 5 years old, although they're out of the most recent textbook on the subject. And with improvements in neonatology and neonatal care, infants of smaller and smaller birth weights are surviving in greater percentages.
Is it entirely a question of weight?
What weight is used as it's something that can be measured. It's really a matter of maturity. And a baby, say a 1,500-gram baby, in one situation may be quite mature in terms of particularly its respiratory system and other vital functions, and another baby at 1,500 grams may not be. So it's just rather arbitrary, and it just happens to be something that can be measured.
Mm-hmm. Is there any, there's no particular time at which you could say that the fetus has, from a layman's point of view, has all necessary parts functioning?
Well, we usually think in terms of somewhere around 34 to 35 weeks gestation. In other words, within 4 to 5 weeks of the due date, that the fetus has at that point attained probably about the same chance of survival as it would have were it to go to 40 weeks. And tests are available now, which can be done by withdrawing amniotic fluid and testing the LS ratio, lecithin sphingomyelin ratio in the amniotic fluid. And by running this rather simple test, it's quite easy to predict whether this infant has a respiratory system which is mature or not. And respiratory distress syndrome is, of course, the thing that kills the premature baby.
That's the last system to develop, the respiratory system?
No, not necessarily the last to develop, but it's essential for life. And some babies at 33 weeks have been found by the work of Gluck out on the West Coast. If a woman say has hypertensive disease, she may have a baby that delivers at 32, 33 weeks, and they find that with the distress that the baby's been under, that it's ready for life and has a normal LS ratio and no respiratory distress. It's also been found that when these babies are born, that if they are ventilated, that within a matter of 3 or 4 days, they will develop an adequate amount of surfactant in the lung, which is what keeps the lung tissue from collapsing. In layman's terms, they find these babies quickly will develop a mature lung. So,
let me see if I got this straight now. The earliest recorded case was 22 weeks that the baby actually lived.
Right.
Born in good condition, and do you know anything about what happened to this
no,
baby?
No, I don't.
Afterwards?
I don't.
I'm just curious if the hospital, or do you know anything about whether or not it was in sophisticated, you know, hospital with sophisticated equipment and so forth? I'm assuming it probably was in a hospital in a more, that had equipment that, you know, could naturally help.
I suspect that's true.
I would like to mention one thing about going back to what Dean had to say about exactly, you know, sort of the synopsis of what the Supreme Court decision was. I do feel that we ought to touch on the point that this decision was 13 months in coming, and the way I understand it, it was the result of two appeals, one from Georgia and one from Texas, which each had two states that had restrictions set on when a mother or a pregnant woman could get an abortion. Is that right?
That's correct.
But did they have, did those two states have any time that abortion was legal?
One of the states had a residency requirement, and this is what was being appealed. I believe it was Georgia that had the residency.
I think that was Texas. Oh. But the medical standards and the consultations and so forth necessary were very, very similar. And I believe that the statutes as they were written would allow abortions only in cases of, the mother's health was jeopardized, or in cases of rape or felonious intercourse, instances like that. But very little discretion.
Excuse me, but we have a call. Hello? Hello? Can you hear? Our number is 864-4530, and we would welcome your comments or questions at any time. Dr. Buck, could you tell us a little about mortality rates for abortion and live births, and that kind, also the kinds of complications that a woman could run into with either one of these procedures?
Yes, the figures for maternal mortality in this country are about 20 per 100,000 births. These figures were 1967 figures. It takes a while for these to be ground through the statistical mill. The figure of 20 per 100,000 applies to the white population. The non-white population, the maternal mortality was 65 per 100,000. Now, until only recently have we had any statistics on abortion mortality in this country. The original statistics on abortion mortality came from Europe and Japan in two instances where abortions are permitted only until the 12th week, and their mortality rate was 4 per 100,000. In Denmark, which allows abortions to any length of pregnancy, the complication rate was 70 per 100,000. So you have to be careful with your statistics to realize what you're talking about and what the particular local situations are. In New York, initially, the statistics were that the mortality rate was something like 23 per 100,000. That has now dropped probably down to about 7 or 8 per 100,000. The big problem with New York statistics is, and this is readily admitted by the physicians in New York who are involved, is that many of their patients are out-of-state patients coming from all over the United States, and their degree of follow-up is admittedly not optimum. California reported experience from 1967, and their mortality rate is 5 to 6 per 100,000. And three of these were early, occurring within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. Two of these occurred after. In one series with saline abortions, in other words, ones done after the 12th week or mid-trimester abortions, the mortality rate may be as high as 200 per 100,000. So there's a tremendous difference in the mortality rates based upon how far along the pregnancy has been.
We do have a call now, and I'd like to go back to that for a moment after we finish to ask you how you would account for those tremendous differences in the mortality rate, for instance, between Japan and Sweden.
Or Denmark,
yeah.
Mainly the ones in Denmark were included a number of them that were done later on in pregnancy where you get your higher risk.
Yeah. Hello? Hello? If you are having difficulty in getting through, please call back again to 864-4530. We aren't going to have difficulty tonight with our earphones, because we certainly wish to take the comments and questions of the audience on this highly controversial subject.
I have I want to just ask Dr. Buck one question. Is that on, of course, on reported abortion? So as far as, you know, any that are not done in any type of, you know, legal setting or, you know, so forth. Is that what your statistics are, or do they include all reported after the fact abortions?
Well, the statistics are ones that are done under legal circumstances. It's been assumed, but no one has ever really had any good figures. But it's assumed that the mortality in illegal abortion is extremely high.
Mm-hmm. I would think there'd be some figures on that, though, of people who end up in the hospital from complications of an illegal abortion.
But that's just never been tied up in a nice, neat bundle. And in talking with the people at the Kansas State Department of Health, who are very knowledgeable about this, they say there are no studies that would reflect this.
Mm-hmm. We've, you know, certainly heard a lot of figures floated about. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to know that there really are no firm figures on this subject.
Along the same line, in turn, you cannot only consider mortality, but you must consider morbidity or complication rate with abortion. And I think there's been some tendency in the lay press, particularly, to make abortion sound as a completely safe procedure, which, like any medical procedure, it isn't. There are complications that can occur. From the New York experience, they were running 7.7 complications per 1,000 abortions. These were done during the first 3 months of pregnancy, and once done after the first 3 months, the complication rate rose sharply to 30.4 per 1,000. And when we're talking about complications, we're talking about hemorrhage, infection, perforated uterus, anesthetic complications, shock, retained tissue, laceration of the cervix, etc. In other words, these are all things that potentially can be quite serious.
But from which people do recover, or else they become part of the mortality rates, is that it?
Well, they could become part of the mortality. The vast majority of them, of course, are managed and their lives are saved. They may end up with a hysterectomy if they've had a perforation, or they may end up being sterile because of infection. So there may be long-term consequences.
Well, increased training, for example, either increased training in medical schools as to the performing of abortions, taking practicing physicians back for seminars and additional training, will this, do you feel, lower those rates of the complications?
Yes, this is borne out by New York, where they were running a mortality of 23 per 100,000 in 1971, and their mortality now is down to 8, and I think this reflects experience.
Let's try again on this telephone call. Hello? There? Hello? Are you on the line? I'm sorry, can hear nothing in the way of a question. Well, we try again. 864-4530. Now, this ruling of the opinion of the Supreme Court affects, as I understand it, the laws in 31 states. Is that your understanding, Dean?
I think so. From some of the articles and magazines and newspapers that have arisen from this this decision, I believe there are about 30 states that are affected significantly. There are only about 4 states in the District of Columbia, I think, that shouldn't be affected much at all by the decision.
Yeah, that's what I have is 4. New York, Washington, Alaska, and Hawaii will not be affected.
And the District of Columbia.
Let's try once again on this call. Hello?
Hi.
No. That's fine. We can hear you now.
Okay. I was intrigued with your discussion in the earlier part of the hour, linking technology with the Supreme Court's decision In other words, regarding the time at which a fetus can be maintained artificially. And what I'm wondering is, say, 30, 50 years hence, if a breakthrough in technology occurs, is this going to invalidate the Supreme Court decision, or in effect make abortion once again illegal? Say, for example, that a fetus, if you would call a fetus an organism that's 2 weeks old, was able to be maintained. Would that do away with the Supreme Court's legalization?
All right, we'll ask Dr. Buck to respond. Could you hear the question?
Well, that's more a legal question that Dean probably could answer. I would say from a medical point of view, there have been attempts to maintain a placenta artificially on a machine which works very much like the heart-lung machine that's used in open-heart surgery. To date, this has not been successful, but there's certainly from a technological point of view and a medical point of view, the caller's supposition is entirely possible. The legal implications, I would prefer not to comment because I'm...
You have an opinion on that, Dean? No.
Well, the court does rely on medical advances, and so I would presume that as new advances are made, that they will have some effect on this decision. It's very speculative to say what sort of effects advances will have.
Now, as I understand, we have another call.
Mm-hmm.
Hello? Hello?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Hello?
Yes.
Could you go ahead, please?
Hello?
Hello? Could you go ahead with your question or comment?
Ellen, go ahead, please.
Okay, I'd like to ask a question about the Equal Rights Amendment, about the abortion law.
Yeah.
And is it legal in Kansas?
Is abortion legal in Kansas? Is that your question? You want to comment on that?
I think that was the question. Abortion is legal in Kansas under certain conditions. Recent changes in the law have released many of the regulations, and I'm not right up to date with some of the court decisions there. I think Dr. Buck has kept up with those. Do you have any comments on what restrictions there are now?
It's my understanding that the requirements that of indications for abortion, which in Kansas included the impairment of physical or mental health of the mother, pregnancy as a result of rape or incest, felonious intercourse, which is defined as that prior to the age of 16, and if the baby might be born with serious mental or physical defects, such as the product of a mother who had German measles during the first trimester, particularly the 6th to 8th week of gestation. These requirements were all in the law, and it's my understanding that with the Court of Appeals decision in Kansas City, these are no longer applicable. Also, the requirement that two additional physicians, and a total of three physicians then, including the one performing the procedure, had to write a consultation to state that the abortion should be done. This requirement has been stricken or was stricken from the Kansas law prior to the Supreme Court decision, so that in Kansas it amounted in practice to a situation between the patient and her physician.
Since the caller did mention the Equal Rights Amendment, so far as I can see, that this constitutional decision was made on another constitutional right, the right of privacy, which already obtains.
That's correct. It relies on the Bill of Rights, and then specifically in the 14th Amendment, a person's right to liberty. Person's liberty cannot be denied without due process of the law, I think is how it reads.
Mm-hmm. And they have not defined the fetus as being a person.
No, under under past decisions, the legal rights that accrue to a person, as is stated in the Constitution, begin at birth, at live birth.
We have another call here. Hello?
Yes, I would like the panelists to comment on the relatively high cost of abortion in Kansas compared to the relatively low cost in New York, and particularly on the ethics of this. And I'm going to hang up so I can hear you.
All right, fine. This caller wants the panelists to comment on the cost of abortion relative from one state to another.
I would like to make one comment on this, because I feel that in my reading that I was doing was that in the past abortion was always available to those who could afford it. This was always the comment that was made, that those who could afford it could always find someone, you know, that would perform the abortion, that hopefully this amendment, which will make it legal for doctors to perform them, may help in reducing the overall cost. I don't know, Dr. Buck may have more, you know, on that, as far as, you know, what the cost is and so forth, and how these are set.
Well, in some ways, mentioning the difference between New York and Kansas, you're talking about the difference between apples and peaches, and it's a little bit difficult to make a comparison. In New York, freestanding clinics are available, and the vast majority of the patient care is done by paramedical personnel, social workers, RNs, and so forth. The physician involved actually spends a very minimal amount of time. Now, up until the present Supreme Court decision in Kansas, it has been a requirement that they be done in a licensed hospital. Okay, when you start talking about licensed hospitals, you start talking about much more expense, because these patients have to pay the same operating room fee, the room charges, the laboratory charges, the things that have to be done amount to greater expense. In addition, more physician time is required, because the patient is seen in the office, a complete physical examination is done, the patient is followed after the abortion. So there's a great deal more physician rendered service in the Kansas situation, and hospital rendered service, and these are costs which everybody knows have been going up. Now, it is true that abortion does cost more in terms of the physician's price than does a D&C. However, it's been well shown that uterine perforation, as an example, just one complication, is 10 times more possible in a therapeutic abortion than it is in a D&C, which is done for some other reason. So the physician is dealing with a higher risk when he's doing an abortion as opposed to when he's doing a D&C. And in most situations where a higher risk is involved, well, a greater charge is involved. So I would say that, as far as the local situation here in Lawrence is concerned, that I can say this quite honestly from having been involved in this from the beginning with the hospital and with the physicians at the hospital, that every effort has been made to keep the cost in Lawrence as low as possible. And it is very definitely on the low end of the range in terms of the total state.
So we'll have to take a station break for a moment at this time.
As you know, this year KENU is again bringing you the Saturday afternoon broadcast.
To a feminist perspective, we always hear the best in public radio, KENU. Here again is KU Dean of Women, Emily Taylor.
Welcome to the second part of A Feminist Perspective. Tonight we are discussing the ramifications of the new, or relatively new, Supreme Court decision on abortion. I'd like to ask what do you people think, particularly from the point of view of the doctor and the lawyer, will be the ramifications for the at least the first 3 months where hospitalization is not required. First of all, what do you think will happen? And secondly, whether you think it's desirable or not. I'm going to have you, Dr. Buck, do you want to start?
Well, I think we will probably mirror the initial experience in New York, that abortion clinics will be set up, and that at some point along the line it will be found that they probably are running a higher complication rate than is desirable or would be present in a hospital, and then you'll have the state intervene, much as the city of New York intervened when this became a problem.
Would they be in a position to intervene now?
I'll refer that to the lawyer.
Well, as a law student, after reading the case, according to the decision, it does not provide for state regulation during the first 3 months, and then continually greater state regulation after the first 3 months. However, in a newspaper article that I have seen, Attorney General Miller said that, according to his preliminary view of the situation, that the current Kansas law comes within the bounds of the decision, and I presume that now, during the first 3 months or at any time, that the state can regulate the conditions under which an abortion is given. Is that correct?
If that's the interpretation, that would still mean that they'd have to be performed in a licensed hospital. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller. Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes. Uh-huh.
All right. My question has to do with the viability issue you were discussing earlier. About 2 years ago, the Washington Post reported an incident that occurred at D.C. General Hospital in which a legal abortion was performed. However, an intern in disposing of the fetus noticed that it was whimpering. And so all the hospital services went into effect to try to save the baby. It lived for about 18 hours, but finally died. And I have two questions. First of all, for Dean, what is the legal implications of an incident such as this? And secondly, for Dr. Buck, what personally happens to a physician who finds his priorities reversed, or do they become reversed from performing an abortion to suddenly being called upon to try to save the fetus?
On the legal implications of that, I really don't know. I don't have the expertise to tell you off the top of my head, and I don't know that the Supreme Court could tell you off the top of its head what the implications are. It speaks in approximations. It says in the period that up to approximately the end of the first trimester, or approximately the beginning of the third trimester, and terms like that. And I don't think that the court, I'm sure that the court has not tried to come up with an absolute formula for this. It didn't make any pretenses to, but it under normal medical conditions and under the medical conditions that now exist, it tried to get as close to that the viability issue as it could. Of course, there's no absolute involved there, and you know the legal implications. I simply don't have the equipment to tell you what they are.
What about from the point of view of the medical profession?
Well, this obviously is a difficult situation, and I think most physicians attempt to avoid the situation by not getting involved in abortions after the first trimester. This has been the case with most physicians whom I know, and so just try to prevent the problem. And I think also from a medical point of view, we know that the morbidity and mortality statistics are so much higher in mid-trimester abortions that they are than would be if the patient would carry the baby to term, that we've got pretty good medical reasons not to get involved after the first trimester.
But if a doctor was involved and faced with the situation, what would the medical ethics say that he ought to do about it? Would you try to save the life of the child?
I think that would probably be true, yes.
Mm-hmm. And do you know anything about the Denmark? You said that in Denmark, at any time, does this mean after labor pains begin, or there's no cutoff at all?
To my knowledge, there's no cutoff. Now, of course, the procedure that's used in the mid-trimester is the salting out procedure, and generally the placenta and the infant are killed in utero by the injection of the hypertonic salt solution. So I would think this would be a fairly rare situation.
when you spoke of the DNC, did you mean that this is a common method of performing an abortion rather than suction method or the saline solution?
Well, when I mentioned DNC, I was comparing a DNC for a reason other than abortion, as compared with what generally is the suction method for abortion in terms of perforation. Mm-hmm. But a suction method is just a variation of a DNC, really.
I see. What we had a question phoned in, but the caller couldn't hold the line, so I'll read it to you. When a child would be born out of wedlock and the parents do not want the child, could this be considered mental or physical detriment to the mother? Or just what heading would this situation come under? And how does this relate to the discretion between the doctor and the patient? Do you understand the question? I presume that means at the present time, under the present law, if the child is going to be born out of wedlock and is not wanted, it's an unwanted pregnancy, is this enough to be considered mental or physical detriment? Well, certainly wouldn't be a physical detriment necessarily, would it?
No.
To be a mental detriment to the mother? Or, of course, now under the the Supreme Court decision, it really is necessary for it to be a mental or physical detriment to the mother, is it?
Well, not during the first 6 months, approximately. In fact, the case that arose in Texas was brought to court by an unwed mother who subsequently had the child before the decision could be made. But regardless, the court did say that in generalizing about some of the reasons for having abortions, they did mention unwanted pregnancy and childbirth out of wedlock. But I can't recall that they definitely put it under a cause or classified it as a cause of impairing mental health. I'm not sure. In the first 6 months, there should be no problem, and then in the final 3 months, these are approximations again. In the final 3 months, then it is a weighing of the potential of life and the health and life of the mother, and I'm not quite sure how that would fit in. It would be instructive, I think, to look at how that's fit into some of the laws that are on the books now.
Well, I think mental health has been used as the predominant, by far, reason for abortion in Kansas during the time that an indication was required, you know, something like over 90%. I think the last 3 months of pregnancy, that mental health probably would not be used very much, and that we probably here would be talking about a situation where there was a severe medical problem on the part of the mother.
Do you have another question or comment? Well, thank you for calling. The implications of the first part of the question, that if a child would be born out of wedlock and the parents do not want the child, don't necessarily go together, do they? I mean, the one who is not going to be born out of wedlock might also be an unwanted pregnancy. So the same thing, I should think, would obtain in either case, but so sort of a moot question, I guess, at the present time, except in that last, what the courts have called trimester. Is that a term that's used by doctors?
Mm-hmm, trimester. Mm-hmm. There are three-month periods, so they're called trimester.
I see. I understand that the justice who wrote the decision spent a long time at Mayo Clinic really studying the entire history of the situation and before he wrote the decision, so I take it that it did have some kind of medical reliability to it.
I was interested to discover that Justice Blackmun was the House Counsel for Mayo Clinic at one point. He's from Minnesota, and then I also understand that he spent his 1 or 2 week vacation last summer at the Mayo Clinic doing research. He did an extensive amount of research into
not only the medical history and medical implications involved, but also the legal history and the social history involved with abortion.
I'm concerned about one thing, and that's this last question sort of brought it to my mind. And of course, no doctor or anyone is going to be obligated to perform an abortion or, you know, be involved in one. But with the relaxed abortion rule on a nationwide basis, I know there has been some concern about things maybe getting back to what it was like before abortion was legal, you know, shopping for a doctor that's going to perform the abortion and so forth. And I wondered, you know, if any way, and you know, maybe we've already touched on this in a way in discussing, you know, licensing and so forth, the facilities, if you foresee this as a problem, Dr. Beck.
Well, I think the states, and I believe Kansas is in the process of doing this now, or at least there has been legislation introduced, will definitely make some regulations regarding the practice of abortion under the Medical Practice Act. And this is just a function of the state, again, to protect the lives of the people that are involved, just like the state licenses the physicians that practice in the state.
How will this affect, like, public health facilities as far as whether or not, you know, they should have this service available if they are a public or municipal health facility?
It's a very difficult question.
Nobody really knows yet, I take
Nobody
it, how it will affect it. I was wondering back there in the question on the fetus that turns out to be viable, is that really the correct word? If that happened a great many times, would there be any, would there be questions raised by medical associations themselves concerning the ethics of the situation?
Oh, there very likely could be. Medical associations per se are more advisory groups in this area. Organizations like the Kansas Medical Society, the American Medical Association, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. The latter two, the AMA and the ACOG, have both issued statements sort of in the middle ground in terms of abortion. Many physicians bolted the AMA when they came out with the sort of the middle of the road thing, which was permissive in terms of abortion. And many of them use the Hippocratic Oath that physicians take as a reason that the AMA should never have come out in allowing abortion or in considering abortion proper. But it's interesting that the Hippocratic Oath, at the time it was written, abortions were performed up until 3 or 4 months of gestation, and it was considered to be okay. So when the word abortion is used in the Hippocratic Oath, it's being used for pregnancies beyond the 4th or 5th month. So this really isn't a very good argument.
How long have abortion methods been known or used?
Well, at least from that time they were done then.
I mean, when was the Hippocratic Oath? That back in B.C. or A.D. or when?
250, 300 B.C., something like that.
Yeah.
So there were techniques known at that time. Certainly we know that in the pagan world, not only abortion, but infanticide was considered appropriate. You decided each time, didn't you, when a child was born, whether it should live or die. So it's a part of the Judeo-Christian ethic that they raise questions concerning the ethical decisions that have to be made there.
I think that Blackmun, in part of his statement, touches on this in a way. I'm reading from an article that was in the January 31st Christian Science Monitor. Justice Blackmun surveyed in his opinion public attitudes towards abortion from ancient to modern times. He recognized that, quote, one's philosophy, one's experiences, one's exposure to the raw edges of human existence, one's religious training, one's attitudes towards life and family and their values, and the moral standards one establishes and seeks to observe are likely to color one or uncolor one's thinking about abortion. And I think, you know, he was relating back to when, you know, way back probably, mm-hmm. you know, even to then, on how people's attitudes and so forth towards abortion are developed.
I think that still would be true today.
Oh, right.
Would it not?
There are some people who would look upon abortion at any stage of pregnancy, even the morning after pill, which would cause real early abortion, as infanticide. Mm-hmm. And I think the significant thing is that the court has opened the situation up to the point that individuals are allowed to practice as their beliefs dictate, and that other individuals are not allowed to impose their own principles on other people. Mm-hmm. And this to me is very important. This happened in terms of birth control. In the state of Connecticut until 1965, one couldn't purchase or sell birth control devices or pills of any kind.
Wasn't it also illegal even to give advice and
yes,
or show methods of birth control? Now that was also declared illegal, wasn't it, by the Supreme Court?
Yes, on nearly the same grounds, right to privacy.
C. Lee Buxton, the late chairman of the Department of OBGYN at Yale, was the one who spearheaded this test case in the court back at that time.
And did not the Supreme Court also say in this case that they were not going to deal with the issue of when life began?
Yes, they skirted that expressly and went to the issue of viability more, saying that that there is a controversy that has existed from almost time immemorial to today, and based on religious and philosophic grounds, and they weren't going to enter that arena and try to skirt it as well as they could and still deal with the issue of abortion.
Well, I think it's extremely important in any discussion of abortion to bring out the alternatives to abortion, one of which is adoption. We know from a medical point of view that this may be safer than an abortion, depending upon when the abortion is proposed. It also allows couples who are not able to have their own children naturally to raise children. And there's been a great effect on the number of adoptable babies since the Kansas abortion law went into effect. Now, the second thing that I think is essential from a medical point of view, and that is prevention of pregnancy to begin with, and adequate birth control counseling and the use of birth control, hopefully prior to the need for an abortion, would be ideal. Secondly, it's essential that any woman who has an abortion, who seeks an abortion for whatever reason, be very strongly counseled in regard to birth control at a future time, whether that be birth control pills in a younger woman or whether it perhaps be a sterilization procedure in an older woman who for sure doesn't want to get pregnant ever again. So I think physicians feel this responsibility very strongly.
Well, I think those are two very important points, because one of the things which sometimes gets forgotten is that, so far as I know, nobody thinks that abortion is a good method of birth control, except right. The Japanese, is that right? They don't believe in birth control, but they do permit abortions, which is rather incomprehensible, it seems to me.
The American medical community is extremely opposed, as you indicate, to the idea of abortion as a primary means of birth control.
Is repetitive abortion sought by the same woman a common or uncommon procedure?
Relatively uncommon. I've seen several cases in this area, but it's relatively uncommon.
So they also, the question that you raised by implication of the responsibilities of schools and of parents and of doctors, of anyone really who is concerned in the case of an unwanted pregnancy, to make sure that the woman is aware of all the possibilities. You spoke of adoptability, and I presume that you would agree that no one should be forced to have a child in order that somebody else might adopt him, but that certainly the woman who is making the decision, an effort should be made to make sure that she knows what all the options are that are available to her, and that she's making this decision of her own free will. Well, what do you consider to be the actual, under the new decision, what do you consider to be the actual role of the doctor and the woman with the unwanted pregnancy? Is his decision to be strictly a medical decision? It says in consultation or something of this sort with her physician. What does that actually mean in practice?
Well, in practice, most women who present for abortion have already been through a considerable degree of agony and counseling and discussion, and by the time they arrive at the office, their minds are pretty well made up that that's what they want, and they feel that is the right thing for them. Now, from a psychological point of view, it's been found that the long-term risk from abortion in a patient who is desirous of an abortion is extremely low. So this business about getting psychiatric consultations is really not very germane, and that's been well shown in some very good studies. Now, the patient who is told to have an abortion, say because of German measles, or say she's 16 years old and her mother brings her to the office and says, you must have an abortion, well, she may have gotten pregnant to try to prove something to her parents. Mm-hmm. In essence, then, the patient who is told to have an abortion is the one who is most likely to develop psychological complications. And these patients, I think, generally physicians have seen by psychiatrists to assess the psychiatric aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. From a legal point of view, would you anticipate that this might lead to people, let's say welfare situations, being required to have an abortion, whether they want or not?
The decision doesn't implicate that at all. The basis, once again, for the decision is a right to privacy, which is an individual person's right, and essentially the decision at the basis, without consideration to abortion, but consideration to this right to privacy, would be diametrically contrary to that forced abortion.
I'm a little less sanguine than you folks seem to be about the decision always being that of the, or practically always being that of the woman herself. If she really was mentally distressed by the unwanted pregnancy, she would also be fair prey for someone else, like the father of the child, to put her in a position where the decision was not her own. You know, I'll marry you later if you have the abortion now, kind of a blackmail procedure, or telling her that this is the thing that she really ought to do. It seems to me that the counseling becomes tremendously important, as it always has been, but remains very important to make sure that that the privacy that we're talking about is the privacy of the woman with the unwanted pregnancy, and not of anyone else who has a vested interest in the situation, the parents.
Except in the situation of a married couple. And in that situation, we require the husband's signature on the operative permit, and I think most physicians do.
Well,
you mean
is
by
that a right?
When you're saying you require it, you mean here,
here
in your particular office?
Yes,
and so forth.
In Lawrence.
Will that be able to stand? What if the woman doesn't want to do that?
Well, the decision, as I read it, and there may be hidden in it somewhere terms in, which would include the father, but it speaks of the woman in consultation with her physician. They spoke this case, and it's important to consider the facts in this case. It was an unmarried woman who brought this case to the court, and when they give a decision, it's impossible to look at it without looking also at the facts. And so they were speaking to an unmarried woman when they wrote this decision. So the case of a married couple has not been presented to the court. It was presented, but they determined not to decide that issue. They may decide it sometime in the future, but as far as that particular incident, it was not decided in this decision.
It seems to me to have much broader implications, though, than just the unmarried woman.
But the physician wants to protect himself from possible liability from this husband.
Except what I'm wondering, too, is, you know, what do you do in the cases of where there's not any legal separation, but the woman is legally married, but she desires, and she is separated, and she does desire an abortion. You still require the husband's signature.
Unless she is divorced.
Well,
this pertains to sterilization procedures, too. This is not just something peculiar to abortion. This is something that's just pretty standard practice on hysterectomies and any operation that will affect her fertility.
I think
so. There's a lot better male rights involved.
Would that, just out of curiosity, would that mean that a wife would have to sign if her husband were, if a vasectomy was performed on her husband?
These generally are not done in hospitals, so this would be, I think, up to the physician in his own office.
Well, what
I'm not sure about what the practice is on hospital-done vasectomies.
Well, what about the physician in his own office or in a clinic in the event that you are tying this in with the hospital situation? I'm sorry to say that our time is up. We appreciate your joining us for this program tonight on the implications of the Supreme Court decision on abortion. We hope that you'll join us again next Monday at the same time in 7 and 8 for A Feminist Perspective.
Listen again next Monday at 7 for A Feminist Perspective.